Side one with Mr. Douglas Hudson.
So now, as far as your actual, we're going through your missions, but we didn't really get too far into which missions you actually did, or how many you actually ended up doing.
31.
31.
Yeah.
Okay.
The last one was to Kiel.
Okay.
Slack and fighters, 10 tents cloud. It was 6 hours and 35 minutes, and then that was it.
Now, in Kiel, would the target have probably been the U-boat pens there?
Yeah, the pens.
Okay, and what type of a load would you have carried, I guess, as far as, if you remember, as far as a bomber?
The highest we ever carried was 12,000 pounds, whereas the Lancaster was carrying about 20,000.
Right.
But we carried 12,000 on the average, depending upon the distance and the, mm-hmm. and the fuel load.
Okay, yeah, and then I suppose attacking the sub-pens required fairly significant bombs, I would imagine.
That's right, yeah, penetrating bombs.
Now, it's on these missions, as far as an wireless operator goes, I would imagine a lot of radio silence would have had to have been held up until the target.
That's right, it was radio silence once. Now, every half hour, the bomber command... bomber command put out a message with regard to winds, changes in targets,
right.
and that sort of thing, and it was came across on the radio that obliterated everything else. It was a special type of a radio that the transmitter that they used that would just cut through everything.
Right.
It would blind everything. It would overcome anything that was on. And we used to get that, and so I would have to pass on the change of winds or the change of targets and the conditions and the change in routes and so forth
right.
on to the navigator and the pilot,
right.
and they would react accordingly.
And then as far as, for instance, the winds are concerned, I suppose there was quite a few changes. You say every half hour they would update it?
Yes.
And I know there were certain raids where winds predicted were significantly different.
Oh, dear me, yes, yeah.
Than those actually. Yes. Were you on any of those?
Yes, yes. They were invaluable, this change of situations.
Right.
I have a note here, 420 Squadron RCAF that I was on.
Mm-hmm.
On the 17th of February 1945, this is the story behind it. Hit a hillside near Shilmore and Cheviots, Northumberland, at 1,600 feet in low cloud, and the aircraft burned. A result of a navigation error on return from this operation, this aircraft is one of three Halifaxes that crashed on return from this operation on our squadron. Now, I'd volunteered to go down, and the wireless operator was sick, and they asked for anybody to volunteer to go replace him. So I volunteered to go. It was a mistake. Because when I got on board that aircraft, knowing our crew and the camaraderie we had and the discipline we had, this crew was no way they were going to survive.
Really?
I knew that. And I said, I've made a mistake here. So we marshaled, but I couldn't back. I didn't back up. So we were marshaled on the end of the runway, ready for takeoff. And the mid-upper gunner said, hey, Red's coming across the field, running across the field. It was Pilot Officer O'Kane, wireless operator. And he said to me, Red's coming across the field, he's going to go with us. So I said, fine. So when he got on the aircraft, I briefed him with as much time as I had because we were marshaled to take off. And went and waved him goodbye, and then I went back to bed. And I got up at briefing time, and went back down to see the crew, see how they made out, and they were missing. And what happened was, this story that some years later, some months later, the tail gunner walked in the mess. And here, I said, what happened to you people anyway? He said, well, I'm the only survivor. He said, when we hit, the tail broke off, and tail turret rolled down this hill. And he said, I was knocked out. And he said, I came to in daylight. And I crawled back up to the crash site, and I said, did you see Red's body? And he said, yes, it was just about this long, and burnt. So anyway, and we went to the bar, and we started to drink. And we threw the glasses in the fireplace. And there were 60 bushels of broken glass in the fireplace. Well, that's just the end of that.
Oh, wow.
But a friend of mine, a six-group historian, researched that crash. And that's what they said. On a hillside near Cheviots, Northumberland, at 1,600 feet, in low cloud in the aircraft were. A result of a navigational error on return from this operation. This aircraft is one of three Halifaxes that crashed on return from this operation. This leads me to another tale.
Mm-hmm.
We were taken off in the evening. I don't remember the target. But we were told to stay below a certain height, because if we got above that height, the German radar would pick us up.
Mm-hmm.
And we hit tremendous icing at the height they told us to stay at. And it started, the aircraft started to become unmanageable. So my pilot said, piss on this, we're going up. The hell with the German radar.
Sure.
So we got above it, and we went on, carried our raid. Now, three aircraft that went down at that time. People have stayed at the height to take it.
Really?
I had a rebel for a pilot anyway. He said, to hell with them, I'm going, we're going up. And the hell with the German radar.
Right.
So anyway, at Harrogate in England, Harrogate, Yorkshire, there's a military funeral. There's 600 people, 600 Canadians buried there for various reasons. And across one end of the graveyard is a wall, and there's 21 Canadians buried there, all in a row. And they were the three aircraft that went down in that icing.
Hmm. Oh boy.
Just
that's, yeah, that actually that raises a good question actually. And you know, these crews were given training, obviously, pilots in particular, in Canada, very by the book, theoretical.
Yeah.
And I suppose there was a steep learning curve in the operation.
Well, yes, that's right. Yeah.
And I guess your thoughts on that? Then you got a pilot. You say that that probably was.
Well, he was a rebel anyway,
right.
And he before we crewed, he was flying over Wales. Yeah, he was flying Wales someplace. And he was on some sort of an aircraft that I'd never heard of before. But he was doing square searches and training other pilots at the time that I was at Milam on the Mark 1 Hansens. The CO there was an RAF station at first. And he didn't like the pilot, and my pilot didn't like him, because he was a rebel anyway. And he was posted, but the CO said, you're not going, you're staying here with me.
Really?
So my pilot was flying with, there was Australians there too. He was friendly with the Aussies. And he said, piss on him, I'm going. And so they arranged that they would cover for him and let him go, assisted his escape from this situation, which he did. And they covered for him. And that's when I met him, when we got. And he was, he appeared before, of course, the RAF put on a search on him, but he'd reported back to the Canadians.
Oh, really?
By this time. And he was hauled up and wanted to know what the story was. And he was a flight sergeant at the time. And he got in front of this office, and the senior officer that was investigating this thing to find out what the hell happened. Why did he disappear? Where did he go? Well, he went back with the Canadians then, and the pilot, the wing commander, I guess it was, the senior officer, he said, well, you might as well join the rest of us and I'm going to commission you.
No. Wow, that's a good deal.
So that's how he got his commission.
Oh, really? Wow, that's
and
incredible.
It really worked out well because he made very good decisions and proper decisions. And when we'd come under heavy flak and searchlights, you know, they had a master searchlight that could waver back and forth and then it would sit on you, cone you. Right. All the other searchlights would come up. And it would become just like daylight up there.
Right.
And then the ACAC gunners would fill it with flak. And you had to take a very quick evasive action or you wouldn't, you know, wouldn't survive. Right. They just fill the cone with flak. And then you took evasive action. Well, when he did evasive action, I don't know how the wings stayed on the airplanes.
You could feel it.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, really?
Just practically tear that aircraft apart. But we'd escape.
Really? Wow. So you were coned then on a couple occasions?
Oh, more than once.
Really?
More than once we were coned.
Oh, that's... Yeah, no, that's a rarity in Bomber Command. Okay, yeah. And then, now, you mentioned Hamburg, and then the other one's Bochum. Now, were you in later part of the war? Were you ever involved in Archie? I remember recalling there being one particular operation on a mission to Nuremberg that was particularly bad. Was that before or during your time?
It was during our time when we were on the
right. Okay.
But they lost. They lost 700 people anyway, that raid. Yeah. 700 aircrew.
Yeah.
We weren't on that one.
No. And then, I guess, other ones later in the war of note, there was Dresden. Were you involved in
no,
that one?
No, didn't get on Dresden. We went to Kiel, though.
Right, Kiel. Yeah, so the very last.
And Hamburg.
And Hamburg. And, getting back to the training, the question here is, now there's in a written history a noted kind of difference between the theory being trained in Canada and then operational, as far as especially pilots mm-hmm. are concerned. And there were quite a few instructors from Canada that were then brought in, that had no operational experience that mm-hmm. were brought in to operational units.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find them particularly or any different than the rest, or was their transition to the operational side of things more
no,
difficult?
No. Of course I wasn't a pilot.
No, of course.
But there were. I can remember when we were at CON unit, conversion unit, we were converting to four engine aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
We were at height, and he started to cut the engines. He cut one, and the pilot got, you know, control of that. Then this two, then three, and then, you know, we were mushing along with one engine on.
Right.
And then he reached up again, and he was going to cut the fourth. I don't know where the guy was, but my pilot hit him on the arm and knocked his arm away, like wonder he didn't break it. I'll never forget that. You know, that was. Who this guy was and where he thought he was, I don't know. Imagine cutting three and then go to reach to cut to four.
I would have broke his arm as well. Okay, I'm just looking through here. Now, getting back to the location of Sixth Group, there was significantly less time to prepare the aircraft for operational units, and also the time between operational units for maintenance was also cut back. Did you ever notice any, or did you ever feel that maybe things were not fully accomplished as far as like on a maintenance aspect goes before the next operation, but it was fairly well? Okay.
We used to get friendly with our ground crew.
Right.
But they wouldn't let us take pictures of them.
Really?
No, they wouldn't take pictures with us. I don't know, I guess they...
Superstition, maybe?
I guess so, yeah.
And as far as being informed of the greater casualty figures of Bomber Connect, during the war, how well informed were you guys at that point in time? Not very?
No. We weren't informed on the overall picture.
It was just...
intelligence ever told us anything about it.
Operation by operation.
Yeah. We just knew that that it was high. It was high.
Right.
Imagine 72% casualties, 52% fatal. It's terrible.
Nah, I couldn't imagine.
100,000 air crew, we lost over half of them fatal.
And I guess then after the war, when these figures came out, was it for you particularly surprising?
I didn't know about it until long after the war.
Long after.
I've got a book in there that tells it like it was.
Right. Okay, sir. Well, is there anything else at all that you would like to just add on a personal note? This is just open for you.
Well, this is a one.
Where
I volunteered to fly. As a result of this, the pilot said, "No more volunteering."
Oh, really?
Nobody's to volunteer for anything anymore.
Like
to fill in for a missing crew.
And that was the CO of 420.
That was our pilot.
Oh, your pilot, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was it. Nobody volunteered anymore.
And the historian you were referring to there, what's his name? I'm curious. Yes. Or it's not particularly important right now. We can discuss that off topic or off tape. But I think that'll be good for the interview. And I'll just stop it here. So this is the end of tape two, side one.